Welcome to episode 49 of The Infectious Myth. I'm your host, David Crowe. In September 2014, the journal Frontiers in Public Health published an article entitled Questioning the HIV-AIDS Hypothesis, 30 Years of Dissent, and a firestorm erupted. The very same day that the article came out, the author, Professor Patricia Goodson of Texas A&M University, was contacted by a vigorous defender of the HIV-AIDS dogma, and the journal launched an investigation. The purpose of the attack on the article was to erase it entirely, but this time the attack failed. Professor Goodson stood firm, did not panic, and let the investigation run its course. Eventually, a token victory was handed to the defenders of the dogma. Goodson's article was downgraded from a research article to opinion, and Seth Kalickman, a psychology professor who represents the defenders of the faith, was given the right to publish an article which turned out to be an attack on the personalities of major AIDS rethinkers, avoiding any discussion of the scientific issues. Goodson's article remained on the website, has received a huge amount of attention, over 18,000 views to date, and following the investigation, it was published on the U.S. National Library of Medicine's PubMed database, which makes the article available to an even larger audience. Seth Kalickman is an interesting character, having previously invented the name Joseph Newton in order to infiltrate the dissident movement. Except that the dissident movement is open, so no infiltration is necessary. It's like wearing a stocking mask and camouflage to go grocery shopping. On the web page for Goodson's article, which is freely available for download, a man with a strange name, Mika Thane, has been commenting, effusive in his praise for Seth Kalickman's position and therefore very critical of Goodson. The strange thing is that the letters in the name Mika Thane come entirely from the name Seth Kalickman, the probability of which is only about 48 out of a million. Could it be that Professor Kalickman is using another fake name to help boost his own credibility by agreeing with himself? This interview with Goodson covers the reasons she got involved in the issue, why she wrote this article at this time, and her feelings and experiences during the investigation by the journal, as well as the discussions of the role of Seth Kalickman. David is joined in this interview by Elizabeth Ely, his co-host on the How Positive Are You podcast. I hope you enjoy it. The article was titled, rather innocuously, Questioning the HIV-AIDS Hypothesis, 30 Years of Dissent, and it appeared in the September 23rd edition of the journal Frontiers in Public Health. We'll talk about what happened after that later in the conversation. Can a scholar just publish the truth without politics getting in the way? The author, Patricia Goodson, has been a professor in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University since 2008. As a social scientist, she researches community health and education. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth and Patricia. Elizabeth, my co-host with How Positive Are You, and Patricia, who I'll call them Pat and Beth, who is the author of the paper in question. Welcome.
Thank you, David. Can I just say one little thing, that I'm at Texas A&M since 1999, actually.
Okay, and a professor since 2008, right?
Professor, yes, full professor 2008, correct.
Okay, that's a long time.
Yes. It dates me. Don't do that.
Yes, I know. I don't want to talk about dates either. Pat, why did you decide to write what is essentially a non-judgmental history of AIDS dissent? It's a paper without any real conclusions, but it's just a description of people who've been criticizing the HIV-AIDS theory for the past 30 years.
Well, I decided to write it, David, because several reasons. First, I am fascinated by this other history of the HIV-AIDS epidemic, with people questioning the hypothesis. And I've always been interested in histories of illnesses and their development, and also always learned that there's always more than one side to the history being provided, usually. So I've always been fascinated by it. I have read a lot through the years about the questioning of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. And another factor motivating my writing the article was that I was beginning to notice that among my students in health education and public health, people don't know the history. They don't forget the criticisms of the hypothesis, just the plain history of how the HIV virus was declared to be the cause of AIDS, who were the players involved, what were the politics and the dynamics and the culture at the time. My students don't know anything about that history at all. And they don't know, they know even less about the questioning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And so that, coupled with a couple of things that started happening around me, that I started paying attention again to HIV. I had been away from HIV as a research area for many years, actually about a decade. And then I started paying attention to articles in the popular media talking about the effects of HART long-term and how those long-term effects were not being studied as much as they should be. And people I knew close to me actually suffering serious effects from HART. I began questioning all of that, putting all of that together, decided to go back and check and see if some of the people that were questioning in the beginning, such as Dr. Duisberg, for instance, were still questioning, because I had stayed away from the topic for a while and saw that he was, yes, still very much faithful, as he says in his emails, always faithful to his views, and that the Rethinking AIDS group has now, at that time, now had a website and was growing and had more people aligning themselves with the Rethinking stance. And I thought, oh, how interesting and how not very well known, especially in my world, which is a very mainstream world in terms of, HIV is the cause of AIDS and that's it. So those were kind of the motivators, basically, for this piece, was to sort of organize the information in a way that was interesting. And that was my only goal, was to organize this information in a way that made sense and that made people do kind of a double take and say, never thought about that or never knew that, which was what happened, actually. I had a couple of my colleagues who read the paper before it was submitted for publication come back to me and say, wow, I've been teaching this stuff for 20 years, 25 years, and I had no idea that this was out there at all. So that was my purpose and my motivation.
Well, I think you definitely started the discussion. I think your articles had, 18,000 views,
yeah.
Which is quite a lot of people who've seen the article. On the same lines of what people don't know, I love the title of John Crutzen's 2002 book, Science Fictions, A Scientific Mystery, A Massive Cover-Up, and the Dark Legacy of Robert Gallo. Like, if you asked most people what the subject of the book is, most people would never think that it was the early years of HIV/AIDS research. That's a pretty dark title for what got somebody the Nobel Prize, not Robert Gallo. Perhaps there's a connection there. Beth, do you have a question to kick things off?
Oh, I was just noting when you said there were 18,000 hits to the article, I just am wondering out loud how many of those hits were from the National Institutes of Health. it just strikes me that they're, from our point of view, maybe not from Pat's point of view, that she's just kind of a historian of this whole thing. But from my point of view, this whole thing rests on such a flimsy foundation that such an article, even just describing the history and the questions that still exist, even saying there are still questions, really can freak out the AIDS establishment, the public health establishment, really, really quite profoundly. And to me, that's just a signal of just how flimsy the foundation is. I mean, there's just one question and one point that's been important for me, and I know you've covered like a lot of aspects in your article, but it should be noted that there is no test for this HIV thingy, just none. Okay, and there's no citation to one even in the response, which we're going to talk about later, by Seth Kalickman. Like, he doesn't have a citation to, you know, a test that claims to actually find HIV, and even the tests themselves say they don't find it in anyone's body. So all the hullabaloo around all the other issues seems to me a little silly. And, I mean, were you prepared for the immense backlash on this? I mean, did you think this was going to happen?
Well, I envisioned, I, I'm, you know, I tend to be naive, but I'm not that naive. So I envisioned that there was going to be a lot of debate. And that's why I chose actually to see if I could get this published in an open access journal, because it is designed exactly to provide a platform for debate. Certain journals even have their review is post-publication. It's not the case with the Frontiers Journal in my article. It was reviewed before publication. But the whole philosophy of open access is to have it out there and have people criticize it, etc. So I did expect a lot of debate, controversy, etc. Did not expect that the day it was published, an investigation was launched. I certainly didn't expect that. And, of course, I was very surprised, like you say, Beth, and I'm with you on this one, that when I was notified about the investigation, that what I was told was that there had been numerous complaints from prominent people in public health, and I quote, prominent people in public health, saying that my article stood to, quote, cause an issue in public health. And
heaven forbid it should cause an issue in public health. I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to do?
Well, but hang on, Beth. Think about it. If one little review article, which is not even original data of my own, right? It's just a review. It's just an organization of the literature that's out there. Stands to cause an issue in public health, I think we need to revisit public health in a way. To me, that is a telltale sign that something's not well here. You know, the patient's not doing too well. Because one little article of that kind can stand to cause an issue. I was thinking, oh my goodness, you know, there are a lot of things that are published out there that you and I don't agree with. We don't pay much attention to it because we know that if it's wrong or if it's untrue or if it's poorly done, etc., it won't stand the test of time anyway. Yes. So why pay attention to it? But I'm not going to go, oh, you know, this little article over here can cause the demise of the theory of what? Genetics.
You know? Yeah, that's quite the house of cards there.
And the
fact that somebody's sitting on top of this so thoroughly that they would respond the same day it came out is really wow. I mean,
yeah,
they're watching this closer than I am.
You know, it's symptomatic of something. And, you know, in Portuguese we have this little saying that says, for the person who understands well, half a word is enough. And in this case, it's like if you understand what's going on, if you know a little bit about the politics and the issues around it, the reaction is very meaningful and it points to something. And I think it deserves discussing and knowing about. So,
well, discussion is an important word because the result of the, if I'm not jumping too far ahead, the result of the investigation was a statement that really didn't say anything, but it was also a response from Seth Kellickman, who's a psychologist at the University of Connecticut. But that's not what they wanted. They didn't want a debate. They wanted your publication withdrawn. They wanted to silence the debate. And so what they got in the end was actually a debate, which is not what they were aiming for.
Right. Well, it's just it's very interesting. And so to answer Beth's question again is, no, I didn't expect any of this. I never expected being here right now talking to you guys about it at all. Never expected 18,000 views on an article because, oh my goodness, it is only a descriptive organizing of some of the literature article. That's all it is. It's nothing more than that. And my only argument, and everybody who read it and supported it understood the argument for what it was. The argument is, there's been 30 years of questioning and critique. Here are the critiques. They come from prominent people who know what they're talking about. It might be worth taking a second look. That's the argument. I'm not arguing for the hypothesis that HIV is not the cause of... that's not my argument. And I've had a lot of critical emails and notes sent to me saying, your argument is false this way, that way, that other. And I'm going, but that's not my argument. My argument is mainly to say there's been 30 years, it's still going strong. Here's some, not even all, because I didn't have room for all, but here are some of the critiques. in an more or less organized way. I hope it was organized.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, you also said more investigation is needed because obviously there are some questions still out there, and you didn't find that they were adequately resolved. Right. The reasonable reader would say, okay, if HIV causes AIDS, there should be no problem resolving these particular questions. Let's go. Right. Let's invite more articles. And then you get the Kaliman article, which doesn't answer any of them.
Yeah. It's problem. Again, it's symptomatic. It's problematic. Some people have said, and I think Anthony's one who said, you know, somebody, if they really want to take on Pat's article, they should go point by point with the evidence she's presenting or organizing and then counteract that. And I think that's a valid suggestion, that's what should be done. But yeah. It's kind of daunting to do that. I don't know if people will want.
Well, I don't know. As I mentioned, they could just go with one point. Is there or is there not a test for HIV?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like if there is one, then argument over, you know. Well, not argument over, but if there is not one, then argument over.
I think that something that Seth Kaliman wrote illustrates the problem here. He wrote, at best, Goodson has confused AIDS denialists' credentials with credibility. At worst, she intentionally ignores their notoriety. For example, Goodson describes Peter Duesberg as a professor of molecular and cell biology at University of California, Berkeley, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. While it is true that he was part of the group that isolated the first cancer gene and mapped the genetic structure of retroviruses in 1970, Duesberg later claimed and still claims that no such genes exist. So it's kind of saying, well, yeah, you know, you're right that this guy has, like, really, really impressive credentials and history. Yeah. But he actually changed his mind on an important scientific issue. And that, I guess, completely goes against, like, the fact that he actually thought about something he'd investigated and said, well, you know, that's not actually the cause of cancer.
Right. Well, also, is that accurate? Did Duesberg later say that he doubted the existence of these genes, or he doubted their importance for cancer causation?
Well, the genes exist, but I think he's doubting he's saying that cancer is caused by aneuploidy, but that's a whole other discussion.
Right. But Kaliman just said that Duesberg said later that he changed his mind. He mapped out the genes, and then he said they didn't exist. Well, as far as I know, he didn't say they didn't exist. I mean, this is the way he slips little lies in there that are kind of close to the truth. You know,
right.
that Duesberg could say, these genes exist, but they're not important in cancer causation. Look at these other things. That's a whole lot different than saying these genes don't exist. But if you're in Kaliman's world, just kind of confusing issues, you can get away with that kind of a lie. And I'm wondering where the fact-checking staff is at these journals. Do they just not have the budget for this?
I think there's some problems where language kind of fails us, because like Peter Duesberg believes that HIV exists but is not pathogenic. So that means that HIV is not a human immunodeficiency virus. And so you could say, well, that means that even Peter Duesberg means that HIV does not exist, but a virus exists, he believes. It just doesn't cause human immunodeficiency, so it should be called something else. And I think the same goes with the genes, that it's true that he believes that no oncogenes exist in the sense of cancer-causing genes, but he does agree that those genes that were identified are real. It's just their purpose that's
genes,
in question.
They're genes, but they're not oncogenes. They're not properly called oncogenes, which mean genes that cause cancer. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. See, they play around with language like that, and it's slippery.
But here's the other thing, too, in terms of playing around, in terms of argument. So if a scientist changing his mind is something that should, according to what was written, be counted against the scientist, the fact that this scientist did not change his mind about HIV/AIDS should be counted in favor of them, right?
Right. He's had the same view since 1986 or 87.
So that should be a positive.
He's been pretty consistent. Yeah.
Yes.
On AIDS, he has. On cancer, he's changed his mind.
He didn't change his mind about the HIV. So it's you know, but I really don't like to play this game of you know, trying to catch people in their arguments and stuff like that. But in the end, the logic gets so twisted that you go, really? I mean, you're trying to attack and then actually doing a favor. You know, I have to thank Dr. Kelligman for what he said in my article about that I did the public a service with my article. And because I informed
by telling us we exist so you can shoot at us.
Well, but he said, well, he said, you know, she did a service alerting people that AIDS denialists, or I don't use this term, but AIDS denialists are out there. And I'm going, yeah, that's exactly what I tried to do, is actually show that
here.
It's out there and it has solid grounding and it should be looked at. So.
Another person he criticizes is Dr. Henry Bauer. And I think what he says about Henry Bauer is quite wrong. He says, that Henry Bauer is a leading authority on the existence of the Loch Ness Monster, which implies that Dr. Bauer believes that the Loch Ness Monster exists. But I think Henry Bauer was just trying to go where no scientists dared go, to study something that everybody knew was false, but nobody actually had any information on. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of brave. And you know, if we're going to dismiss a theory like the Loch Ness Monster, well, surely somebody has to actually take it seriously enough to actually go look at the data and see what people have. But that apparently disqualifies you from discussion of any scientific issues if you've ever looked at something controversial.
Right. So if you like science fiction like I do, like I like Star Trek, that disqualifies me as a scientist, right? Of course.
And of course, I don't know if you mentioned that Kerry Mullis writes about his own personal drug use in his autobiography. I can't remember if Kalikman mentioned that, but people often do. But, you know, Kerry Mullis is obviously a very creative person, and some people believe that they get creativity through drug use. I mean, I'm not one of those people, but who am I to say? I'm not also a great artist or an incredibly creative scientist. So if somebody does LSD and has this vision and it ends up producing polymerase chain reaction, you know, does that disqualify them as a valid scientist because they use psychoactive substances?
Well, then you got to disqualify everybody that drinks alcohol, smokes cigarettes, drinks coffee like I do.
Yes.
Stuff like that. I mean, right?
I plead guilty on alcohol and coffee.
Yeah, mine is coffee.
Yeah, mostly coffee's my drug of choice. I hate to hand them that bone. They're going to use something. You know, they'll use that against me later. But they'll say she was freaked out on caffeine, and that's why she said these nutty things. Which I just say nutty things anyway. So,
Can I interject on something here before I forget?
Yeah.
If you notice, Dr. Kelligman doesn't say a word about James Chin.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you notice there's no reference to him? And James,
can you explain to our listeners just who James Chin is?
James Chin is the epidemiologist that I have listed on the table of prominent people that question, have raised questions. He is very mainstream. He does believe HIV causes AIDS. But he worked with the World Health Organization. He worked with the California Department of Health chief epidemiologist. And he questioned the quality of the epidemiological data, the data about the distribution of HIV cases, AIDS cases, deaths, etc.
How many there are in the world, in other words.
Yes. And so he actually worked with the WHO for a few years with the United Nations AIDS program. And he turns around and wrote a book, and he criticizes the data very strongly. So it's somebody that is mainstream in terms of the cause of AIDS, but he has raised serious, serious questions about the quality of the data, which hinge on the issue of the definition of AIDS, for instance, on issues of testing and availability of testing worldwide. All of those things make the data very problematic in themselves, all of the revisions that have been done to the data. And so he does a very sobering critique of the epidemiological data. So I brought the epidemiological data as an arm to the sets of questions that are being asked about the HIV AIDS theory. And Dr. Kelligman doesn't even mention him because, you know, he's beyond reproach, and I'm sure he is beyond reproach.
Well, to go there, to mention Chin, you'd actually have to question his data, and that would take some homework. That would take work. And these people usually take the shortcut, just saying, you know, I'm either not going to mention that person, or I'm going to say that they drop LSD or something.
Yeah.
The other person they don't like to talk about similarly is Montaigne, because Montaigne has said many things, and you talk about the fact that he admits that he never isolated the virus. But he's also said, you know, things like a person with a strong immune system can eliminate HIV in a few weeks and things like that. And although he got the Nobel Prize, it's kind of like he's the mad uncle that, you know, you invite to the birthday parties, but you don't really want to talk about him and you don't want to talk to him.
You have one of those?
No.
I don't know. I don't have one of those. At least he doesn't get invited to birthday parties. But
I don't like to talk about him.
I should mention for our listeners that if they're interested in James Chin and in Luc Montagné, there are partial interviews of them and even full interviews posted on YouTube. But there are edited interviews of them on House of Numbers, which they can view for free on YouTube. And so they will get up to speed on who Chin and Montagné are in case they've never heard of this stuff before.
Can I ask a question about one of the interesting things about Seth Kalickman is that he sort of went undercover using the name Joseph Newton. I don't know if you know about this episode, but I started to get all these emails from Joseph Newton who seemed to have multiple personality disorder, and it may have been actually because multiple people were writing the emails that I was getting. But he claimed to be a student of public health. He was a bit vague about where he was. He did tell me it was Connecticut, but he never said which institution, what he was studying. It wasn't just me. It was several people. I think Henry Bauer and others also got emails from him asking these questions. The irony is that once we figured out who he was and said we weren't going to talk to him anymore because he wasn't a real person, the next day I get an email from Seth Kalickman. At that time, I didn't know it was actually Joseph Newton. And I responded immediately to his question, even though I knew that it might not be in my best interest, but he'd asked me a question, so I responded as honestly as I could. But what are the ethics in your, you know, you're in the field of public health. Like, do people normally use false names and things like that to gain information?
That story was the first I've ever heard of anything like that happening. It's not normal practice.
I don't know if you remember, David, but I was actually the one who ratted out Joseph Newton. I figured out, I think it was Henry Bauer who had been corresponding with him and passed an email of mine along to him. To Joseph Newton, and through some trail of breadcrumbs, we figured out it was Seth Kalickman. And I don't know if you also remember, David, but this is kind of funny too, that the two of us, some months or maybe a year later, wrote directly to Seth Kalickman an email saying, you know, from now on, you don't have to dress up in someone else's clothes or pretend like you're someone else to talk to us. You have done this, apparently this whole book about us and our friends without actually like identifying yourself as doing research on us. And we need to tell you that you can just call us up and we'll answer any of your questions. And you know, that we never, I don't believe we ever got a response to that. And I believe you sent it, David, but I think that's an important footnote to this, that I'm not sure that these are approved research techniques by the academic standards boards, if there are such at the University of Connecticut or anywhere, or even, you know, for people getting government grants.
Well, I think in general, if you were to, Pat, you know, probably know a lot more about this, but if you were to do some research and you wanted to fool people into thinking that you were studying one thing when you were studying another thing.
But David, there's a difference here. And that difference is what is defined as research. And writing a book, so doing interviews with people to write a book may not be considered research at all, and he may not have ever needed or gone through institutional review board or ethics committee approval at the university, because the definition of research that these ethics committees go by is the federal definition of research, which defines research as systematic collection of information for the purpose of generalizable knowledge. And so books such as what Dr. Kalkman wrote would probably not be considered research.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Had it been research, had he said, I need to do a study and I will publish findings from the study in professional journals and present it at conferences, there that qualifies as generalizable knowledge. He would not have been able to do that research, A, without approval from the university. And if he was using deception, he would have to have a mighty good reason for using deception, and then afterwards would have to debrief. So it couldn't be deception all the time. He would have to interview you and then say, by the way, this is what's going on, and here's what I'm doing. Are you still okay with my using your data type of thing? And the Institutional Review Board, I know from personal experience, they don't like deception. And allow it very, very infrequently. And in this case, I bet it was not construed as research. It was construed as interviews, talking to people for writing a book. Therefore, it doesn't fall under the definition of research.
I also thought that the whole thing, as Beth has pointed out as well, it was kind of unnecessary, because we would have talked to him even knowing that he was a mainstream researcher. But by using deception, he was kind of creating the illusion that we were some secret society, which is contradictory to the fact that people like us are trying to convert the world to our viewpoint. So how do you do that if you're running a secret society? It seems contradictory to me.
But also contradictory to like who we really are, which is pretty guileless individuals.
Slightly naive.
From like the Canadian and American Northern Midwest. I mean, you know, like just completely not quite as sinister as anyone can make us out to be. And I had a question about that. What if doing this book, which I understand doing a book as a journalist, I don't always have to let people know what I'm up to when I'm asking the question. I just ask the question. I'm under no obligation to like take their stance on it, or even to identify myself sometimes, or to identify the fact that I'm recording them. But what if a person writing such a book under no such standards and restrictions is receiving grant money from the U.S. government? Doesn't that change things? I mean, I was under the impression, now correct me if I'm wrong, or there's no proof for this, I don't know, but I was under the impression that he received something like $10 million to do this research on us.
Well, I think we need to be careful. He claims
that
he received no government money to write his book. And I don't think we have any evidence to the contrary.
So where did that rumor come from?
Well, there's a lot of rumors running around. I think we need to be careful not to go too far.
What if he received U.S. money to write that book? Wouldn't there be some consequences to that? To going undercover and being, you know, the secret life of Walter Mitty going on?
If he had gotten money or grant money to write a book, first of all, it would be very unusual that there would be money just for that. And second, all grant mechanisms that I know about, federal, state, etc., have the requirement that if it's research, that it be under the supervision of an institutional review board, an ethics committee, and you would have had to follow all of the ethical principles and procedures of, you know, informed consent, informing person, etc. So I don't know. I'm thinking that writing a book was something that he did not get funding for specifically.
Quite possibly, because he went slumming on blogs for months, and even now, even like blogs dealing with Christine Maggiore's death, where he would quite distastefully sell his book there and just say, you know, by the way, I wrote this book. Like, he's so desperate to sell this book and I guess make money from it. But so that would tend to make me believe there's no government money involved, but I don't know.
Yeah, I would say there's probably, this is just an opinion, probably no money involved in the book itself. But of course, you know, that issue of conflict of interest that was not highlighted in the commentary in the Frontiers page is very frustrating, because we are asked, when you're authoring an article in Frontiers, you're asked to disclose any conflict of interest related to funding or research related to what you are writing about.
Right.
And so there was, you know, no declaration of conflict of interest. So that can be...
Well, there was a statement that there was none on
both
articles.
That's what I'm saying.
The author declares that the research was conducted in the absence of any commercial or financial relationships that could be construed as a potential conflict of interest.
Right. That's
now, if somebody's receiving, say, a grant from a pharmaceutical company or you know, the Bill Gates Foundation, and this furthers their prestige with the organization, I don't know. I mean, I would think that that would be a conflict of interest, that people need to check this out.
Yeah, it is.
For you as well as him. I mean, you obviously, you know, you would believe you have nothing to hide.
Right.
I mean, he has, Seth Kalickman has, according to public records from, I think, the NIH, received well over $30 million since the late 90s for research, mostly into HIV. I think he's also done some similar research into people who question the use of vaccination. But most of it was for HIV and AIDS, which is a pretty substantial amount of money. And obviously, $30 million didn't go into his pocket. It went to pay for his research, and it went to graduate students. But certainly a percentage of research money goes into the pocket of the professor, even if it's indirect, such as a professor who brings in tons and tons of research is more likely to get a promotion and a higher salary, and in essence, some of that money is coming from the research funding.
Mm-hmm. It's rare that, well, at least in my world, that you can get the money to come to your pocket at all, but you need to support your research agenda, your laboratory, etc. Now, I'm just thinking, you know, there's another issue. Isn't he editor of a big AIDS journal also, AIDS and Behavior, I think?
Probably, yes.
Yeah, so that in itself might be something to disclose as, you know, I'm going to talk about this topic, but please note, reader, that I am also, you know, I've done this kind of research, this kind of funding, and editor of this journel. So anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're talking a lot about Seth.
Yeah, let's get on to a different topic.
Too much
about him.
Yeah, yes. I mean, because I really think that there are real people out here who are suffering and confused about health decisions, real health decisions that they're making, and real legal ramifications of those decisions. And, you know, then you have this place called universities where people just argue with each other. And it's, yeah, to me, that's the most uncomfortable part of this conversation is, you know, here's conflict of interest and here's this and here's that. And the consequences for people are huge. I mean, did you apprehend any of that in your going over this topic, just how important this is?
Yes. A couple of people writing me directly, Beth, and saying, thank you so much for writing this article. I have made certain decisions related to my HIV care, and this really helped organize the information I already knew. Nobody came to me and said, this is new stuff, of course, thankfully. They said, I already knew this stuff, but thank you for organizing it this way. It made it clearer for me. It helped me make a decision. Now, got to remember, Beth, my intent is not to affect care. It's not to, you know, get people on meds, off meds. I can't do that with a
release,
and I don't intend to do that. And it's not my role. I don't have the expertise to do that. But if organizing the information helps people think clearly or a little bit more clearly about what they're doing or how to even go about their own care and negotiate it with their providers, then wonderful. But
yeah.
I agree with you that the tragedy is in the human lives that are having to make decisions related to medication, that are having to go through a diagnosis like this, and then hear all of us on behind the scenes fighting each other, you know, and when their lives are at stake and their well-being and their health are at stake. But I can't go beyond my role. My toolbox is education. and social science research. I can't go beyond that. It wouldn't be ethical, and I don't feel competent to do it even unethically.
You are involved in education related to sexual and reproductive health. So what's the state of AIDS education in that area? I mean, are people given simplified facts with no indication that there's any questions about those facts?
Right. Exactly.
It's
still very, very, very mainstream and very, you know, HIV is the cause of AIDS. You pick up any human sexuality textbook, college level, for instance, pick up any of those and look up the HIV AIDS information. So HIV is the cause of AIDS, no questions asked. There's not even a mention that HIV has been proposed as the cause of AIDS. However, a few scientists disagree. Nothing like that. There's not even a mention of that.
Well, talk about the toolbox and mm-hmm. your role as an educator. And I think that at the very least, such people as the audience for this deserve the tools to mm-hmm. understand mm-hmm. just where knowledge is at this point and a navigation tool. They may disagree with our side of the argument, but they will at least have the navigation tool. As you say, it will at least be mentioned that there is a debate. And that's the number one point that Kaligman, sorry to bring him up again, was making. He said, you know, he didn't want to leave the impression that there was a debate. However, he talked about the advisory panel for Tabo and Becky, and saying, you know, he invited these nut jobs basically to come sit on this panel. Well, those so-called nut jobs, and he didn't say nut jobs, but he implied that they were scientists
from both sides.
They were the fact that he invited scientists from both sides means that there was a debate, and the fact that it upset the likes of Seth Kaligman means that there's a scientific debate. Mm-hmm. There is one, and people need to be notified that there is one.
I think I had the privilege a few years ago of sitting in on a doctor's visit with a recently diagnosed HIV-positive man, and when the doctor described the CD4 cell count as a prognostic factor in the progression from HIV to AIDS, it was so incredibly simplified that I was really shocked that there was no room for any debate, and all the numbers are neatly by 100. You know, 500 you start to worry, 300 you start to get your first opportunistic infections, 200 you get KS, 100 you get PCP, and 0 you're dead. Like, it was just so cut and dried. And I've looked a lot at the CD4 literature, and I know that even if you're a mainstream scientist, like, you couldn't with a straight face say that CD4 counts were that accurate, that you could say that everybody with 200 is going to have the same kind of severity of illnesses. But that's what people who are HIV positive are faced with.
It is. Right. It is what's being promoted, and the simplistic version, and in the sexuality education materials, the push for testing, for everybody to get tested. And now, you asked me about initially what was my motivation for writing this article. What really got me back to looking into the whole thing again after about a 10-year period of just not dealing with it was the whole idea of PrEP.
Mm.
So when I started...
Pre-exposure prophylaxis, which we've done an episode on.
Prophylaxis, yes. Or basically treatment as prevention, right? Mm-hmm. I started seeing articles about that in the cover of The Nation's Health. The Nation's Health is a little sort of a newspaper type of newsletter that comes to the folks that are members of the American Public Health Association. So it has the association has its journal with the technical articles, and then has this little newspaper with just news bits and pieces and stuff. And I started seeing a couple of mentions of PrEP and in the front page of The Nation's Health, promoting PrEP, how there was going to be an agreement with Walgreens to help provide community education campaigns, how the World Health Organization was going to start using us, health educators, to do community health education to promote PrEP. And that started really concerning me, the fact that it's almost like giving chemotherapy to your 14-year-old daughter so she doesn't develop breast cancer. It's the same notion.
Yeah.
And I'm going, and nobody's saying anything. So I looked at these articles and thought somebody must be raising some questions, whether this is an appropriate procedure or not. No questions, nothing. That this is it. We're pushing for this. Health educators are going to help. And I'm going, oh my goodness. And we're training these health educators, and they don't know anything about these drugs. They don't know about the side effects. They don't know about the history of the development. They don't know anything.
And this is Truvada, right?
Yeah, Truvada.
And this is what it says on the label. Lactic acidosis and severe hepatomegaly, which is swollen liver, with steatosis, which is fatty deposits in liver, including fatal cases, have been reported with the use of nucleoside analogs alone or in combination with other antiretrovirals. It talks about renal impairment, decreases in bone mineral density, redistribution, accumulation of body fat, et cetera, goes on and on. And this is the manufacturer's own label on the drug. And I wonder, have very many public health advocates read this information?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I was going to say, David, you know, this sounds like a job for a chimp, not somebody with a master's degree in public health, you know, just advising people to go on PrEP. They just read the propaganda and they look really concerned, and they have a master's degree on the wall, so people believe them. But it's like a disconnect between the amount of education and the way you're supposed to act in a propaganda run system. Which I wonder if I think you were going to say something, Patricia, but I just had to, you know, interject there. I mean, that's really dangerous.
Yeah, Beth, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because the volume. No, just think about it. The volume of information that you need to master to be able to be a good public health educator, for instance, the volume of information, you have to, at some point, at least for some things, rely on trust, right?
Yes.
So that's
scary.
Most of science, but that's how most of science functions, and that's how most of all systems function, is based on trust. So when your role is to go out, motivate people to take PrEP if they're at high risk for HIV infection, you rarely have the time, the motivation, or even the cue to an indication that there might be a problem. You're just so concerned about learning that information and finding ways to communicate it well and people accept it. It just doesn't sometimes even cross people's radars, but it's not because they're mean or ignorant, or
no.
It's just because the way the system is structured, it just doesn't allow for that.
It's that word cue. You haven't been given the heads up that there's an issue,
right?
If you're working in these fields.
I think the word education also, like when I was in university, I was lucky enough to go to a small, obscure university studying a not high-profile subject, biology. And I sort of had the freedom to actually sort of self-educate and to study the things I was interested in without any preconceived notions. But when I see public health education, I think now it's like we've defined the parameters, and we're going to persuade people this is right. It's not a two-way street. It's not like when I was in university and I could challenge my professors and say, well, you said that, but I'm not sure I agree with it. That was allowed, but that's certainly not what I think of as public health education.
Yeah, but also, we're doing big generalizations here, and I hate doing big generalizations because I know of a lot of people in public health and health education that are incredible thinkers.
Right.
And they raise questions, and they think outside the box. I hate the cliche, but they think outside the box, and they're thinking. And I would say, David, that evidence of that is that they didn't pull the article in Frontiers.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
So
I think that what I find scary. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say somebody in Frontiers in the public health area in the journal, and the Frontiers in Public Health is a new journal, new journal, started recently. I would say people there must have gone to bat for saying it's important that this stay.
Yes.
You know? Therefore, I wouldn't generalize in terms of public health.
Yeah.
But I would say...
I guess what I was saying about what's scary is not that there are, you know, all these, you know, total idiots in public health or something, but the job actually, you know, of educator, given this complication of all the information, does seem sort of, you know, just read the instructions and tell people to go on prep, you know, this job for a chimp thing. But also, it's really scary when a field becomes so complicated.
Yes.
So complicated that even the people practicing it have to rely on just rote knowledge. And to me, that's a sign of a danger in a highly technological society, that people will hand over their power, not just those, you know, if those people with the master's degrees can't keep up with it, how is the person, you know, a single mother landing in her doctor's office being told that she's positive, how is she going to sort through that? And it's taking your power away, saying, there's more information here that you don't know about, we know about it, shut up. Will make your decisions for you. And I have to say, I find that scary, that even very ethical people can not get the heads up call that there's something wrong here because it's all so complicated.
I agree with you, but I think that totally agree. But I think that that's an outcome of the incredible complexity we have related to knowledge nowadays. But what I am also finding is that, surprisingly enough, among some of the healthcare providers out there, there are some people that are a little bit more humble, and they say, look, this is complex. This is not as simple as it appears. Patient, you and I, let's work together and figure this out for you. And I've seen a couple of examples, and that gives me a little bit of, you know, little pockets of... Yeah. Pinpoints of hope in that there's some really good people out there. But as a system, as an educational system, as a public health system, the systems are getting incredibly complex, and more than just sheer knowledge of what you need to know to be an effective health educator, Beth, is just amazing, because you need to know the science, you need to know, and we're very eclectic, so public health people rarely specialize in one little area, so they know about diabetes, and they know about HIV, and they know about obesity, and they need to be prepared to work with communities, and so they understand policy and politics and research, and oh my goodness, it's daunting, actually.
Yes.
Mm. It's amazing that anything actually works, right?
Right. Well, to get back to the outcome of your article, I mean, in the end, your article stayed. It was eventually indexed in PubMed, which means that it's now available to anybody who uses that very important index, which is managed by the National Library of Medicine. And I think that anybody who reads, you know, puts your article up against Seth Kalickman's will, you know, stand a pretty good chance of siding with all the data that you've organized as opposed to the ad hominem attacks of Kalickman. So in the end, it was, I think, a major victory for the right to have open discussions about public health. So
I think so too, David. And you know, I want to give a big shout out for everybody that supported this, a really big thank you to everybody, because I had a lot of people write the editors at Frontiers in support of the article and actually questioning why an investigation even. But a lot of those people that wrote don't agree with what I said or with what I organized. A lot of people, including I had a former boss of mine in Brazil, that he read the article and said, Pat, it'll never convince me that HIV is not the cause of AIDS. He said, but you've done a fabulous job of organizing those questions. He said, I'm not convinced. I still think HIV is the cause of AIDS, but thank you for doing this piece. I think it's very informative. And a lot of people, again, that wrote the editors were writing for the freedom of scientific debate and the right to have a position or present a view that's not very popular and let it stand on its own and be debated in public forum, right? So I was very actually overwhelmed by the positive support that I got, even from people who think very mainstream-like and think there's nothing to question, actually. But they fought for my right to have the article stand. And for that, I'm very grateful. And for all of your support, everybody's support, everybody that wrote. I'm just very, very, very thankful and humbled, actually, by it. That, again, it's just the review article. It's just a tiny little thing.
Well, it's a review article with 18,000 readers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome, isn't it?
Yes. Well, thank you very much for spending an hour with us today. I really appreciate being able to have a conversation about this and get some more insights into it. Beth?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the, you know, given the complexity of things, that it's very important that we have articles like this summarizing the debate and giving them the heads up that there is a debate at the scientific level. And there's great humility in that, that this is just knowledge. It has nothing to do with you personally. And just to say that... ironically, you know, I'm supposed to be rooting for our side, but ironically, I would like to see someone respond to these articles in substantive fashion, like actually take on the issues that they raise instead of, you know, oh, we stopped listening to those people 30 years ago. I want to know, you know, where is the test for this HIV? Where is, you know, where is the data on how something called viral load neither finds virus nor counts it? Okay, what is your theory on that? You know, why? How does it correlate with anything? So I want to hear that stuff. I want to read that stuff because basically I want to retire from this. Okay, I just don't want to argue it anymore. But they can't give me a cogent argument, and as long as they don't, I really salute articles like yours that just lay it out for people.
Well, as long as the no counter argument is provided, you just assume there isn't one, then, right?
Yes.
Well, that's what I've assumed.
I think that's what I'm assuming too. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate it too.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.